is Greater LA, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today, we're off to Century City to check out an art exhibit on hip-hop. Yeah, maybe not the first place you think of when you're imagining LA's rap scene, but bear with me here for a minute. The Annenberg Space for Photography has a show called Contact High. Contact, like contact sheet, those pages of photos laid out in a grid that you view after a photo shoot. Now, some images on display are the iconic ones you probably know. A shirtless Tupac Shakur with the Thug Life tattoo across his stomach. Kanye West in a bear costume for his college dropout album. But behind each picture used for an album or magazine cover, there are reams and reams of shots that ended up on the cutting room floor. The so-called outtakes. This exhibition shows you those outtakes and a whole lot more.
Feel me? I heard.
So this is Jay-Z's first press shoot, photographed by Jameel GS, who photographed, you know, a lot of early hip-hop.
Journalist and author Vicky Toback curated the show. She grew up in Detroit and worked in the record industry in New York, representing artists such as Gangstar. The photos of hip-hop history grace the walls of several corridors at the Annenberg, and they're snapshots of some of rap's greatest stars, such as Jay-Z in New York.
It's the World Trade Center.
It's the World Trade Center. And that was, you know, that was Jay's choice to be photographed. You know, for his press photos, he really wanted to make a statement about symbols of greatness, symbols of, you know, wealth, and symbols of the come up. And to him, you know, the World Trade Center really represented that. So he wanted to be photographed in front of it. The contact sheet shows, like, him in front of a Lexus, him in front of a yacht. So there were all these, you know, choices that he
made.
Symbols
of capitalism.
Symbols of capitalism. And again, like, using that photo to show it. Statue of Liberty. Long live the World Trade. Long live the King, yo. I'm from the Empire State. That's
money and power are often exemplified with these pictures. Expensive cars, flashy jewelry, a more regal look for some artists who barely scrape by early on. But you also get a glimpse of those humble beginnings as well. Like a 17-year-old Biggie Smalls rapping on the streets of Brooklyn. He's on a video screen in this long corridor of still photos. Now, right next to that screen that shows this loop of Biggie rapping is arguably his most iconic photograph. It's the one, and I know you've seen it, it's the one where Biggie's face takes up the entire frame. On his head sits a gold crown. It's called the King of New York. Photographer Baron Claiborne took that picture in 1997.
I wanted to do him as a king because that's how I had seen him the whole time anyway. So I got the crown. I didn't really tell many people. So he came to the studio with, you know, his entourage, Puffy and Little C's and some other people. And I had the crown, and I remember at first Puffy got mad because he said that he would look like the Burger King. And, you know, I was like, whatever. And Biggie didn't really care, so he did it. And the picture is beautiful. I mean, I just like archetypes, you know, kings, queens, you know, all kinds of things, strong men, clowns, you know, whatever, saints, all those kinds of things I've always liked. So that's kind of what I was doing. I was kind of doing icons at the time. And it's kind of ironic that it has turned out to actually be the icon it has become, because that's actually what I was trying to do. So that, in a way, that's why I love the photo also. Hold y'all, breath, I told y'all, death controls y'all, big don't fold y'all. I spit phrases that'll thrill you. You're nobody till somebody kills you. You're nobody. Now, King of New York became an iconic photo in large part because it was one of the last photos of Biggie before he died. I remember he was at my studio, and then he was on his way to go to California. So it was his last studio photo session. And I remember Puffy being concerned because he was going out to the West Coast. And this was during the whole, you know, East Coast, West Coast dumb feud that was actually imaginary. So I think he was really worried about him. And I remember when it happened, I had went to Paris. So I heard about the news in Paris and people were sending me pictures of different places where they had put that photo up of him. So I'm glad that he's remembered that way. And I'm glad I had something to do with that. I always feel connected to him in that way. You have Bruce Lee, Marilyn Monroe, James Dean. People sort of idolize people when they never get to see them deteriorate, you know?
And next to that photograph is the crown that Biggie wore.
It's kind of a cheapo crown. It's like
It has not aged well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is what it is.
I mean, it's got some rhinestones in there,
And
it's signed, too. Look at that. Do you see it?
Oh, no, I never even noticed
that. It is.
That.
Look at that.
What?
Bronx. You see it?
Oh, wow.
Didn't it say Bronx?
It says Biggie.
Next to the crown is the contact sheet, which shows a much sweeter side of Biggie than the one we see on T-shirts and posters today. Like in one of the outtakes, he has this big, goofy grin on his face.
The contact sheets really humanize the artist a lot more, especially in a world like hip-hop, where image is often very, you know, hyper-masculine and, you know, that's also can be a beautiful thing. But when you look at the contact sheets, you just see a wider array of who they were as people. And you see them, you know, making their mistakes. And you see the in-between moments. And you see them, you know, cracking up or smiling. And, you know,
we don't have contact sheets anymore, do we? We have bursts on our iPhones, or on our Android,
and they often get deleted.
And they often get deleted. Yeah.
Now, moving through this exhibit also gives us a geographical and chronological history of hip-hop, from East Coast, centered in New York, to West Coast rap, centered right here in L.A.
I said a hip-hop, you don't stop the rocket to the band, man. Boogie, say up, jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie to beat.
Definitely, you know, California both sounded and looked markedly different from New York and from the roots of what, you know, hip-hop started as in the South Bronx. So, you know, in the late 70s till, you know, until California really started to make its mark, like the images that you were seeing and the sound that you were hearing was a very East Coast sound.
Yeah.
So you had the, you know, Shearlings and you had the, you know, Dapper Dan jackets and you had the shell toe Adidas and you had a very specific sound coming out of New York. And then when we started hearing LA with this like G-funk influence with, you know, all this very different look with car culture.
Da, 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 da. It's the one and only Digo Double G.
Snoop Dogg. Snoop Dogg.
Da, 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 da. You know what happened with the D-R-E.
You know, that was mind-blowing, especially at a time when hip-hop was still pretty regional.
And then we've got, of course, Thug Life over here, Tupac, who makes the song about the state very famous. Well, Vicky Toback, I want to thank you for hosting us and the folks here at the Annenberg Space for Photography, and good luck on your show.
Yeah, thank you. I'm happy to, you know, have it in L.A., open in L.A., the best place for it. So thank you.
The exhibition Contact High runs at the Annenberg Space for Photography in Century City through August 18th. By the way, in, well, just a little while, give us a minute to put it online. We're going to have pictures of that exhibit, too. Check out. And we're at kcrw.com/greaterLA. We're on podcast as well, wherever you get your podcasts. So check it out there as well. Coming up, a new documentary introduces you to the folks who own the old Circus of Books. You may be surprised who they are and what they're like at home. There was a bit of conflict there. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. If you owned a couple of gay porn stores, what would you tell your kids? Well, Rachel Mason had to find out the hard way.
Do you remember when I found out about the store?
Yes. You had said, my parents own a bookstore. I said, oh, what bookstore do they own? You're just like, oh, they own a bookstore? You probably never heard of it. It's called Cirque of Books. And we were like, Cirque of Books? What? Rachel, Cirque of Books is a porno store.
Once there were two Cirque of Books stores. Owners Karen and Barry Mason closed the one in Silver Lake nearly 3 years ago. They closed the one on Santa Monica Boulevard in West Hollywood back in February. And Rachel Mason chronicled the store's closure for a new documentary that highlights her family and highlights those stores. Cirque of Books was recently picked up by Netflix. And this Thursday night, it opens Outfest, which is LA's LGBTQ film festival. And Rachel is here with me at KCRW Studios to talk about it. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Steve.
When did this happen, by the way? When did you first find out that your parents did this for a living?
Yeah, like that clip just showed, that really was the moment my friend Fernando, high school friend, Cleveland High School, shout out, he revealed to me that that's what the stores were.
Fernando was an employee too, right?
He eventually became an employee, yeah. Like a bunch of my friends after high school who thought it was so cool and were, you know, deeply into counterculture, queer culture, asked me to introduce them to my parents and get them jobs, so I did.
You had been in and out of the store, though. Did you not see some of the merchandise that was going on in there?
Well, so, you know, as a kid, I walked in, there was candy, and that was what I was interested in, and that was it. And I was like, oh, there's candy. Cool.
Yeah, yeah. Kids love candy.
Right, and there was an over 18 section, and I just assumed every store in the world had an over 18 section. So that was my child's perspective. It goes to show you that that's how a kid views a porn store.
What did you tell your parents when you found out?
It's still vague to me exactly how it went down when I approached them about it, but they're, as far as I remember at that time, it was still like, okay, well, just don't tell anyone, just forget about it. Like, you know, yes, we own a crazy business, something along those lines.
Were you embarrassed?
No, I thought it was so cool when when I figured out what it was. But I'm a weirdo. I love anything that's out there. So I just thought it was so strange because my parents were straight-laced, boring, not interesting people who forced me to do things I didn't want to have to do, like go to Sunday school, etc. And I just was like, they can't possibly be doing something cool and interesting. That's my friends had cool, interesting parents. My parents were not that.
Your mom was particularly religious, right? She grew up going to temple.
Yeah.
She was pretty strict in that, conservative Jewish woman. So traditional parents, heterosexual parents, three kids. How did they end up in this line of work?
You know, funny enough, they went from basically just trying to find a way to make a living. I think were both practically unemployed. And, you know, my dad had just sold a dialysis invention machine that he was creating. And my mom had left journalism, and they really just needed a sideline. And as the film tells, they accidentally got in by delivering Hustler magazines.
Hustler, of course, Larry Flint's magazine publication right here out of Los Angeles, right off of Wilshire Boulevard, as a matter of fact. And your parents were the first among distributors to really get it out there, pushing it to bookstores, right, and other shops across L.A.
Yeah, and Larry Flint was really ahead of his time as a just sort of maverick businessman. I mean, he was, you know, obviously he made this publication that at that time was really out there. Now it's not at all, but at that time it was totally impossible to get mainstream distribution. And he just said, I'm going to do it myself. And he really just set out to find local independent distributors people literally putting magazines in their cars and distributing. And that's what my parents did. They responded to an ad to distribute Hustler.
Your mom all along had misgivings about all of this. I want to talk about how they opened this bookstore in the first place.
So how they got into the bookstore in the first place was through distribution. They were distributing Hustler, and this store was on their route. And it was just a really great store on their route. But the twist is that Larry Flint picked up a few publications for distribution, one of which was a gay title called Blue Boy. And at that time, there were no gay magazines. I mean, it was like a crazy thing. So this store at the heart of West Hollywood, which was still a very young city, was getting lots of copies of Blue Boy. And my parents just really didn't care. They would just deliver whatever to whomever. And so they got, you know, lots of publications of Blue Boy. The store wanted it, and they delivered tons of copies. And at some point, that store started to have serious trouble. And basically, they were able to take over this business, which had already been thriving. And they didn't come in with their own agenda. Okay, we're going to turn this place into a Barnes & Noble or whatever. They just said, all right, how do we keep this thing going? And then they basically were great stewards of that business.
They kept the merchandise. They kept the clientele. And all the while, your mother was just horrified by this, right? I want to play a clip because she had real misgivings about owning a porn store.
I never felt free to let anybody know what we did. If you went somewhere and you said, well, I own Circus of Books, people would say to you, oh, I don't have any problem with that. So it was like you were being judged. I mean, you don't go up to somebody when they say they're a teacher and say, I don't have any problem with that, or I'm a lawyer, I don't have any problem with that. But they would say that to us, I don't have any problem with that. And they probably did have a problem with that. I had a problem with that.
It's such an interesting thing because she resents feeling judged, but at the same time, she's judging herself.
Totally. It's, yes. I mean, my mom's conflict is what makes this movie interesting, 100%. She's a very religious, you know, she's almost aligned with the hardline right who were condemning this business. She herself, on a moral level, is almost aligned with that.
Yet she's operating this business.
Yeah. Because of her own family values, which is also the twist, is that this store was their way of supporting a family.
And yet she hated the things that she was selling. There's one point in the movie at a vendor show, she goes through table after table, barely discussing what it is that she's actually buying. She says, I'll take that because it sells really well. I know people like those things, and she's picking up. I won't even talk about some of the things that she's picking up. And then she looks at this wall of items, and she says to the camera,
I don't particularly enjoy looking at it, so I can notice it without looking at it. So this wall would probably do well for us, whatever it is. That's it. Now, can we go?
Now, can we go? She was ready. And that wall, by the way, had some items. Again, you can use your imagination on it. I don't want to use the radio for it, but there are a lot of things on there. Sexual toys.
Toys.
Yeah. Toys. Adult toys.
Anatomical parts.
There you go. How does she do it? She hates the stuff.
You know, it's so interesting. I was thinking about this at the beginning of that scene. There was one woman who was selling some lube, I think, actually. My mom, you know, at the end says, you know what, thanks, Ellen. That was a nice order. And there's this kind of little bit of like, yes, she sort of hates it when she's, you know, talking to me and publicly talking about it. But behind the scenes, there's a lot of admiration, I think, for the people in the business, putting together the orders and doing the little things. And I actually think, because my mom is so business focused, she loves business. She really does. And yeah. I think she's such a small business owner. There's a lot of respect and admiration for the people within it on every side. And I did notice these glimmers of like, you know what? Great job. This is great. These products did well. Obviously, you know what you're doing. You know, that's the kind of interesting side too, is that I got a glimpse into the world that no one talks about or sees, which is the adult toy industry.
The adult film industry, because they also dabbled into that as well. They became one of the biggest distributors of adult films in the country. Pornographic films.
Gay, straight.
Gay pornographic films. Let's hear a part of that.
See, all these boxes are full of DVDs. All the titles on this list here.
You guys made all of those?
Yeah, I was sent you to college.
These are the videos that sent me to college?
They certainly helped.
That's you and your mother going through boxes of gay pornographic films, DVDs, and she's telling you that they helped send you to college.
And the really amazing thing that we cannot see on the radio are the titles that I was filming, because they are priceless.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Like.
I cannot say them on the radio.
Really? Okay.
But they're amazing, so yeah. You can watch them.
Yeah.
And they do scroll past the screen. They're hilarious.
What were you thinking when you're looking at all these titles and you're thinking, oh, my gosh, my very, you know, pretty Orthodox Jewish mother sent us to Sunday school, went to temple every week, you know?
It just blows my mind. I mean, I will say this may be a different segue, but what blows my mind about it is because I'm an artist. I've always been the person that she didn't understand in the family. I do what I do because I care about it. I'm passionate about it. I don't care if it will sell, which sort of breaks her heart if there's, you know, I'm not a commercial-minded person. And yet, what she does is so out there. It's so extreme. And yet she's always thought what I do is, you know, being an artist. And, you know, why are you writing songs? Why are you going to waste your time on this thing?
Yeah.
You don't know that it's going to sell. You know, and I'll be like, well, I care about this thing. It's for me, it's this funny thing when I look at, like, Mom, okay, so this is what you did. This is so out there. It's so hilarious and so funny. And you think what I do is so crazy.
I don't want to say she doesn't think about her family, but like something really hit her, because your brother Josh is also in this documentary, and he is gay and struggling like really hard with this fact through high school and into college, went to Columbia U, came back from New York to tell your parents. Let's hear Josh.
I distinctly remember gay being a bad word. It was one of those words that you used about bad things. I definitely perceived that it was wrong.
And it was wrong.
Yeah.
There's a moment that you're interviewing your brother, and you see the pain in his face, and he's telling you that, you know, I bought an airline ticket, I paid for it to make sure I could get back to New York in case, you know, my family didn't want to see me again. And you break up a little bit. You're like, I had no idea you were going through this pain.
I was so amazed by the struggle he had that I really only came to realize from making this film. I didn't quite wrap my head. So yeah, I actually really broke down in the interview because I didn't know that he had gone through that.
And your mom really didn't take it well.
Well, that's the other really crazy, the thing that is, I think, the crux of this movie. In a strange way, I think it's a movie about religious and family values stuffed inside of a porn store.
No problem selling the stuff, the pornographic magazines and the films and distributing all of those things. But when it came to her family and her son...
My dad had a completely different reaction. He's the most mellow guy in the world, and he's not religious, too. And I think those things go hand in hand. My mom had to go through a crisis of religious values that she emerged from. And I do think that that's part of what makes the film so hopeful and great, is that I really hope that people can look at my mom as an example in that way.
And in the end, she and your father joined PFLAG.
Yep,
Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, the L.A. chapter. She's marching in the L.A. Pride Parade.
They're huge activists now.
This is where the sunlight lives on the ground. It's where lovers meet when they need to be found. It's where you gave me the look that took me.
Mason, director of Circus of Books, playing Thursday night at Outfest over at the Orpheum Theater. Will open on Netflix later in the fall. By the way, you wrote a song that plays over the end credits, too, and we're going to play a little snippet of that. And I want to go out on that song called Give You Everything. Rachel, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Steve. Appreciate it.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, a project that looks at the most expensive homeless folks on the streets, meaning the people who require the most help, the most medical help, housing, etc. One program that could be the key to alleviating the worst of the homelessness crisis. That's tomorrow on Greater LA. Next on KCRW, it's DNA with Francis Anderton, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Reg Warna, Christian Bordahl. They all make this show happen. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA and on podcast too, wherever you get your podcast. Hope you'll sign up there. We'd love to be in your inbox every single day right here at Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for the ear. Thanks for your time. Let's do it again tomorrow. Have a great day.